Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The message from the United States is quite clear. Democracy, democracy, democracy. Let the people decide. Well, the people of Pakistan have spoken. Last week's election has put Islamic-based parties into power in the two provinces that border Afghanistan, elevating the same politicians who are demanding that all U.S. soldiers leave the region. On the national scene, the only party backing President Musharraf captured fewer than a quarter of the available seats, while Islamic parties won more seats than even the analysts expected. So the old scramble for coalition partners and alliances is on again, and even before a prime minister is chosen, there's talk that General Musharraf will continue to run the nation as a military dictatorship. Connection listeners, what is the lesson for the United States in the results of Pakistan's election? The current alliance between the USA and Pakistan is a vital one. Does that hold regardless of what the voters say? One version of this election has Islamic radicals voting their way to control of a nuclear bomb. Is that really the democracy America is determined to support? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With me on the program today, Owen Bennett-Jones. He was BBC correspondent in Islamabad. He's just published a new book called Pakistan, Eye of the Storm. He joins us from studio in, where are you, in Oxford?
No, I'm normally in Oxford. I'm in Cambridge today.
You're in Cambridge. Yeah. Owen, nice to have you with us.
Good to speak to you.
You say in the introduction to the book, ever since its creation, Pakistan has grappled with the issue of what role Islam should play in the state. And it's just like all over again. Here we go, right?
Yeah, that's true. It has been the central issue of Pakistani history. The country was started as a homeland for Muslims, somewhere for Muslims to live safely. And the debate ever since has been, is it just that or is it actually an Islamic state? And the debate really hasn't never been resolved. The Islamic parties who argue for Islamic law for an Islamic state have never done very well in the Pakistani elections over the years. They've never got more than 5%. This time, they've made a strong showing in the, as you say, these two provinces by Afghanistan, the Northwest Frontier Province and Baluchistan. And maybe, you know, that's the Pakistani people saying, we've tried everything else. We've tried democracy. We've tried military rule. It doesn't work. Let's give these guys a chance.
So when the EU observers say that it really wasn't a very fair election, there seems to be a bit of a lie put to that by the voters saying we will choose these Islamic parties
in these two provinces. But I mean, you know, you can't really have a fair election where the two most senior politicians in the country, two former prime ministers, Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif, are both unable to stand, which was what happened. Now, you know, the military would say there are good reasons for that, that they're both facing corruption charges, that their governments were absolutely atrocious, and a lot of people would agree with that. But at the end of the day, the two people who do have the most support in Pakistani politics, right or wrong, were not standing. So it's very difficult to argue that these were free and fair elections.
Oh, and your book is a history. It tells the story, the past 50 years of a country that has been trying to figure out whether or not it takes its lead from politicians, whether or not it takes its lead from the mullahs. Now, can you help us with an understanding of the results that we're looking at? Are the Islamic parties any stronger than they were before? Is it just that the politicians are weaker? Why are we seeing the results that we're seeing? Owen, are you there, Owen? We seem to have some problem with our studio connection to Cambridge, so we'll while we just double check on that, we're going to Shakir Hussain, who's been standing by. Shakir is a Pakistani columnist and reporter who writes for a number of newspapers and online magazines. He's joining us from Karachi. Shakir, can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can.
Thanks for being with us. I'm interested in knowing not so much the details of which coalition is hoping to match which coalition, but just in general, how are people in Pakistan reviewing the results of the election? Are they saying, is it a vote against America, as is being reported in so many of the stories here?
Well, I don't think it's entirely a vote against America. It's a number of things, and one of them is, yes, U.S. policies in Afghanistan, and especially recently with what's happening in the Middle East, and also the fact that a lot of U.S. security services are sort of operating in the Northwest Frontier province. So, yes, sure, there's been a backlash, but it's also as a result of a political vacuum that's been created in Pakistan by keeping, you know, Nawaz Sharif and Benazir out.
So nobody would, their supporters didn't even bother going to the polls, and in effect the more radical parties came sneaking up the middle?
It's not that their supporters didn't bother going, but yes, sure. I mean, these elections, I was in Lahore at the time of the elections, and, you know, it was like it was unlike any other election because hardly anyone was out in the street. I mean, you know, you didn't really get that whole election vibe going.
So there wasn't the excitement that there was in 97, the usual sort of big rallies, nothing like that.
Definitely not. And, you know, that also had a lot to do with the election rules. There was a lot of uncertainty. And, you know, the parties really didn't have a chance to get into the swing of things.
So what are people saying in Karachi when you sit down to talk with friends about this? Is anything going to change?
Well, I mean, obviously the army is going to retain control of, they will call the shots, I mean, with President Musharraf in, and he's got the legal framework going to do that. But sure, I mean, with these religious parties in power, getting the kind of seats they have, I mean, you know, if you just look at the National Assembly, the MMA has 53 seats. You know, that is quite a number, and they will sort of be very vocal about today you had the Jamaat-e-Islami president, Qazi Hussain, saying that, you know, U.S. troops should leave Pakistan. So that does put General Musharraf on the back foot there.
Owen Bennett-Jones, are you back with us there?
Sure am, yep.
Sorry, we lost the connection for a minute there. Just talking with Shakir Hussain about the about how people are viewing the results currently in Pakistan. When you look at this in historical terms, Musharraf has lots of precedent for saying, I don't actually really like what you elected politicians are doing in the province of Balochistan or North. He could just knock them out of power if he wanted, couldn't he?
Yeah, and he will. I mean, he'd much rather they stay put and gave the appearance of being in power. But, I mean, there's no doubt. This is a military government, and that's one of the reasons the elections were so unexciting, was that everybody knew that after them, whoever was in the parliament, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference, because General Musharraf's there. He took over because he had a gun. He's still there because he's got a gun, and he will be in charge at least for 5 years. And this parliament is, in a sense, window dressing. It helps appease the West. It helps it make it look as if he's going back to democratic norms, and that's what it's for. So, you know, the local governments will be there. They will have some control over the police, over some sort of local issues. But if any of them ever tried to, for instance, impose Islamic law in Northwest Frontier Province, that's not going anywhere. The general doesn't want that. It's not going to happen.
So has anything changed at all?
No, these elections were really, you know, remarkably unimportant in a way. I mean, they're useful, as I say, as a tool to use to persuade the West that he's done enough to give them some cover when they say that they're going to back him. You know, the West wants to back him. He's a key ally in President Bush's aggression against terror. And that means that, you know, it's useful for America to have these elections. It looks, everyone can say he's moving towards democracy. But the fact is, he's in charge. The West's quite happy with that. Everyone's happy.
So, Shakir, help me with your sense of this, because if the Islamic parties feel like they won a little bit of power and a little bit more support from the people, and if, as Owen suggests, it'll simply be taken away if they actually try to do anything with it, what happens then?
Well, I mean, in the sense that the West, democracy hasn't really been of real concern to the West. I mean, I think it's window dressing there as well. I mean, you take Algeria as a case, test case, and, you know, when the Islamic parties came into power, it was fine with France and the U.S. to say, hey, you know, the army should move in. So, yeah, I mean, I think Owen is on the mark there. But, you know, they do have a lot of nuisance power. And I think while before this election, we had the luxury of saying, well, you know, the religious parties only have, you know, 5% or 10%, you know, of support in the country, these elections have shown that, you know, they've you know, taking down some serious seats in the National Assembly. And they control essentially Balochistan and NWSP. So a lot more nuisance value there.
What is nuisance value, though? What is nuisance power that you're describing?
Well, I mean, the religious parties, historically, they've been the ones, after the 70s, definitely, where they've been able to come out in the streets in large numbers. They've been able to sort of have their strikes and their, you know, people out in the streets protesting, saying a lot of stuff. And that hurts business. That hurts, I mean, that hurts every aspect of our life here in Pakistan. I mean, you know, it does affect us. And, you know, each time the city is shut down, you're talking about quite a few billion rupees going down the drain, like, every day. So, yeah,
it goes,
I mean, you know.
Go ahead, Owen.
Yeah, I mean, it goes further than that, doesn't it? I mean, you're absolutely right. They've got this capacity to bring people out onto the streets and to have street demonstrations at will. But, you know, the fact is that the Pakistani middle classes are terrified. I mean, it's a small group, but nonetheless, they're an influential group in Pakistan. And they're terrified of these people, that they're going to come in one day, that the religious parties, if they ever did take over, would transform life completely, maybe along the lines that happened in Iran, that, you know, a lot of normal things like women being able to drive, women being able to work, people being able to go about their lives as they see fit, you know, not being made to pray five times a day, not having to observe Ramadan, at least if they don't want to, all those things would go. It would become an Islamic state. Now, that frightens a lot of people in Pakistan. And before now, whenever Westerners have come along and said, you know, there could be an Islamic government here, they've said, ah, typical Western commentators exaggerating the problem, giving a sort of stereotypical view of Islam. That's changed now, because these people, although, you know, this is not on a national scale yet, but nonetheless, in these two provinces, they've made huge headway, and there are reasons for it. It's because everyone else has failed. And now it becomes clearer that this could happen, and that will rattle a lot of Pakistanis.
So when the White House declares, Shakir, when the White House declares this is an important milestone in Pakistan's ongoing transition to democracy, is that just seen with cynicism in Pakistan?
Oh, totally. I think so. And, I mean, going back to what Owen was saying, I'll disagree, because Iran, I don't think, is a good comparison, because, I mean, the mullah is in power. They're quite educated. They've gone through Qom. They are pretty forward-thinking, and women do work in Iran. And so, I mean, these guys, I mean, I think a lot of people are terrified of, this lot in part. I mean, definitely. And, you know, this is going to impact a lot. And, I mean, the whole thing has been created. It's a lot of backlash. I mean, it was just bad timing. If Musharraf had these elections maybe 6 months ago, the results would have been totally different.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, and we are talking about the results of the Pakistani election and talking about it in terms of the aftermath of the great explosion in Bali, about the tanker set on fire in Yemen, the U.S. soldiers being shot in Kuwait, and a refocusing of the United States administration, albeit perhaps somewhat slight at this point, on its war on terror and its principal ally in the war on terror, which for the past year and a couple of months has been the country of Pakistan, and whether or not, as Pakistan makes its bumpy way through the South Asian version of democracy, the United States will continue to stand by a country if the Islamic radicals move closer to control of that country. 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Looking at the results of last week's Pakistani election and the reaction of the White House, is America really committed to democracy in the Islamic world? Letting the voters have their say, letting the voters decide. 1-800-423-TALK to join our conversation. With me, Owen Bennett-Jones. He was BBC correspondent in Islamabad. He's just finished a new book. It's called Pakistan, Eye of the Storm. Shakir Hussain is also with us. He's a columnist in Karachi, and he's joining us on the line from there. Owen, let me start with you, because in your chapter on democracy, you start, democracy has few supporters in Pakistan. I'm hearing from what you're saying that it hasn't got a whole lot more popular in the last few days.
Well, the problem is that it just hasn't gone terribly well. I mean, there are lots of people who'd love to live in a decently run democracy in Pakistan. The vast majority would hope for that, but that's just something they've never had. And, you know, when you look back at the last decade of democracy with Nawaz Sharif and Benazir Bhutto, I mean, it is difficult to imagine less competent governments. I mean, these were just atrocious governments that failed to concentrate on any serious issue, that every other week were coming up with these absolutely absurd sort of great, you know, master plans, which were going to sort out everything. I mean, every week, every month, let's say, you know, we're going to build new houses all over the country and it's going to unlock everything. It'll all be resolved. These incredible sort of announcements were made. And at the same time, gross corruption in a country where a lot of people are so short of cash that they literally cannot feed their families. It is not unusual to read stories in the Pakistani press of parents, fathers who have committed suicide and maybe sometimes killed their children with them, I read in one story, because they just could not feed their family and they felt so ashamed. And in the same country, you have people with millions, and quite a few of them, with millions in the Swiss bank accounts, in the London banks, with their fantastic flats on the Park Lane and all the rest of it. And it is gross. And when people look at it and say that was democracy, they say, well, frankly, there has to be something better.
But Shakir Hussain, General Musharraf came in and said that he, like other dictators before him, was going to fix this. Has anything changed in the last 3 years?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, as a 27-year-old Pakistani who's come back from the, you know, from abroad back to Pakistan to work here, I can safely say, yes, he has. I mean, you know, he's taken steps in the right direction. Now, sure, some of them have worked, some of them haven't. Now, I don't think it's fair to just write him off just like as another sort of pomp-hungry dictator. I mean, he's done some things which the general population of the country say, good, you know, sure, throw these politicians out. We don't want them running in elections, you know, confiscate their properties. Fine, he hasn't gone as far as he should or as far as some people would like to see him go, and it hasn't gone as quickly as he would have liked it to, but these are, again, steps in the right direction.
Let me hear from both of you on a question that I want to bring the callers in on, and that is whether or not the United States is seen to be a real friend of Pakistan at this point, the economic or the military lifeline that's either going to benefit just Pakistan or both countries. Is the United States seen as committed to democracy, to the betterment of life of people in Pakistan? Owen, what about you?
Well, you know the answer to that before you ask it. I mean, of course not. Nobody thinks that the United States is serious. It was put to me by a great Pakistani scholar, Iqbal Ahmed, who sadly died like this. He said, the United States relationship with Pakistan is that between an errant husband and their lover. And sometimes America will run towards its lover, Pakistan, with a great tempestuous desire to get help to look after Afghanistan with the Soviets or the Islamic Lord or whoever it is. And they will be shower with the mistress with gifts. And then suddenly afterwards, they'll lose interest and just drop it like a stone. And then you suddenly find once again, America needs Pakistan. And once again, we hear that our long-term commitment is here. We'll be with you for the long term. And of course, it's not true. And many people in Pakistan are very, very upset about it. And they think that the United States should have been there over the last 10 years, and it hasn't been there. Once again, for totally selfish reasons, the United States needs Pakistan's help, and it just expects to get it with a click of a finger. And I've no doubt that Pakistan will be abandoned once again. In fact, many people think it's already happening. I spoke to a Pakistani official the other day here in London who said, we expected you to abandon us, but not as quickly as this.
Shakir.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Owen here. I think no one has any illusions about, you know, the U.S. role for democracy or any of the other sort of stuff that, you know, that's touted in the press or by the State Department. I mean, you look at the Afghan War, the second the Soviets were out, you know, the U.S. backed up, said, thank you very much. You've got your 3 million refugees. You deal with it. You've got your heroin. whatever, I mean, we're out of here. And, you know, if you look at the creation of the Taliban, you know, Benazir's government, in fact, with General Nasirullah Babur. I mean, it's ironic that General Babur, Nasirullah Babur, lost in these elections to an MMA candidate. And these were the very people they helped create. And, you know, we all know about Unocal's dealing with them. We know State Department officials meeting them. And all of a sudden, you know, Afghanistan it is again. And Pakistan right there on the front line as, you know, the front line state against the war on terror this time. So I don't think anyone has any illusions.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Lexington. Mike's on the line. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
I think that this question you've posed, is the United States really interested in democracy in Pakistan, is kind of a silly question. We hooked up with Musharraf because we are trying to save our neck from militants in Afghanistan. That's why we're in bed with Musharraf. I mean, how important is the question, are we truly interested in democracy in Pakistan? Come on.
Well, what about the control of the nuclear weapons and whether or not that's in the United States' interest, Mike?
Well, of course it's in our interest. But my point is that this question of agonizing over we're really interested in democracy, it's not even an important issue. It's not a good framing of the question. It's not what's important over there.
I'm not sure that the same message is coming from
our point of view, not from the Pakistanis' point of view, from our self-interest.
Yeah,
Why in that case was that the major theme of American foreign policy throughout the first 2 years of the Musharraf regime? That's all we heard from America was you must let back the Democrats, you must give us a roadmap for democracy. That's
because,
you know, all the sanctions depended on it.
Because that's what served our interest prior to September 11th. The world has changed since then.
Well, okay, Mike, but since September 11th, the president has talked in even more elaborate terms about exporting American values to places of the world like Pakistan so terrorism can be controlled. Is that just nonsense?
Well, that's kind of a global statement, which I'm sure he would support, and most Americans would. But let's get down to realpolitik. And it has to do with saving our neck over there. I don't know. You're off the point. You're talking about something which is so naive. We're interested in democracy in Pakistan so long as there is an even higher priority that comes.
Is that your view, or are you just characterizing the view of the government? I mean, how would you see it?
That's my view, and I think it's so obvious that it's the view of the United States. How could it not be the view of the United States? I mean, why do you think we've cozied up to Musharraf?
Shakir Hussein, that sounds like Mike's basically expressing what you were saying a couple of minutes ago.
Yeah, I mean, you know, historically, the U.S. has supported dictators all over the world. I mean, you look at Latin America, you look at Southeast Asia, you look at Pakistan over our 50 years, you know. When it's been convenient, you know, fine. And, you know, everyone has this thing with Benazir where she's, you know, wined and dined at the State Department because she's went to Harvard. She can speak good English. She's a woman. And, you know, everyone says, hey, you know, we should have democracy. It's a great thing. But the bottom line is, you know, U.S. self-interest. Where it suits it, great. Yeah, sure, we can be democratic. Right now, the U.S. government is dealing with a lot of Central Asian states where they have total despots running the country.
Owen Bennett-Jones, this same attitude of the American providing assistance to the Afghans in the late 70s against the Soviets resulted, we are told, in the blowback that created the Taliban, and that lesson was supposed to have taught somebody something.
Well, that's true. I mean, it's happened many times that groups sponsored by superpowers turn out to do something else and turn back on their masters. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, Osama bin Laden himself was probably the recipient of U.S. funding when he started out his career. And it is an irony. And you would think and you would hope that policymakers would take that kind of long view on board when they take decisions. But I'm afraid that most of the politicians in democratic countries seem to work to a far shorter time frame than that.
Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. Mike, thanks for your call to Green Bay, Wisconsin now, and Todd's joining us. Hi, Todd.
Hi, good morning. I'm just curious, and one of the things that I always hear is that
The United States has got involved for whatever the reason might be, and now the United States is responsible for maintaining the government, and now the United States has failed to maintain that commitment and things. I don't know how many commitments we can be expected to maintain around the world, but I am curious, with as much emphasis as is put on everybody wanting to do everything through the United Nations, why is it that we don't hear that the United States and Canada, for instance, have failed to maintain a democracy in this country or failed to further the cause, or the United States and Germany, or the United States and, France is not much of a democracy, but, the countries that have more freedom than most of these other countries that we're involved in, but at least share, some of our common goals of free market trading and Western civilization. Why is it that we never hear that the United States and an ally is helping and is doing this together, and that the two of them have failed? It's the United States. We're condemned for going in to help out in any case, and then we're condemned for not following through. But we also seem to be the only people that are getting involved in these kind of situations, and it's always easy to take a shot at the person who stands up and takes action. So we're always undergoing criticism constantly.
Easy target if you're standing at the front of the pack, Owen?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's because the United States is so powerful. I mean, you enjoy that power, you enjoy huge economic wealth over there, and you have to accept that if, for example, the U.S. government imposes sanctions on a country like Pakistan, that devastates the Pakistani economy. If Canada does the same thing, if the U.K. does the same thing, it has nowhere like the same impact. So the United States does have huge power. It manages to influence not only what goes on in the developing world, but also to shape international opinion in the West. And if the United States takes a lead, then basically people drop into line. You're seeing it over Iraq. And, lots of countries don't agree with what you're proposing over Iraq. They're all falling into line. The United States enjoys the benefits of being the dominant power in the world. You have to accept the responsibilities. And don't forget that when the Soviet Union was your rival in power, that many people did talk a lot about Soviet responsibility around the world, and they used to criticize the Soviet Union and discuss the Soviet Union's leading role in various countries of the world, in Eastern Europe and in various parts of Africa and East Asia and so on. The Soviet Union's gone, you're left, you're alone. You've got to take the heat when you take the decisions.
Todd, thanks for your call. 1-800-423-8255 to Kerry, North Carolina now, and Kevin's on the line. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. Yes, glad to be on the show. My main question, it seems like you're heading into this direction, but no one's asked this question directly. Are we playing the same game, the same dangerous game in Pakistan that we did in Iran? And do we run the same risks that bit us in the tail, you might say, in Iran? Are we driving the populace down to the point that they're going to explode in our faces? And I'll be glad to take my answer off the air.
Yeah, we actually got a little bit close to that a little earlier in the program. But, Owen, just look further afield and tell me whether or not you think that what Kerry's describing could happen.
Well, yeah, the interesting point about this is what happens to Islamic governments when they've been in power for quite a long time. And if you look at Iran, as we've just heard in the program, Iran today is becoming quite a reasonable place to live. And I think most people would agree that 15 years ago, unless you really were quite a radical Islamist, it wasn't such a reasonable place to live. And the government there is moderating. It is allowing a variety of opinion to be heard. It is allowing contested elections and so on. Now, that compares with the situation in Afghanistan, where the Taliban were in charge for only, quite a short period. And maybe if they'd been given longer, they would have developed into a more reasonable government, where by most people's standards, it was a pretty aggressive government. And it was, not an easy place to live, although many people would say easier to live under the Taliban than to live under the current regime in Afghanistan. But nonetheless, it does give you some indication of the kind of difficulties you have when you look towards what an Islamic government would look like. And I think the point to make is that it's not always as black and white as people make out, and that it can be a genuine solution for these countries and one that can work well for quite a few other people.
Shakir, you made the point a little earlier in the program. You're 27 years old. You've spent some time abroad. You're back in Pakistan now. You're talking to people there about what their own expectations are, and people want a job, income, some kind of future. Is there any, if you look across the street, are you also seeing people saying, we're not going to get any of that from either our own military leaders or elected leaders, so we might as well, support the mullahs?
I mean, economic ground realities, that's the bottom line. And, people at the at the end of the day, that's exactly what people are looking for. You know, they're looking for jobs, they're looking for incomes, feed their kids, send their kids to school. The values of, I think, you know, everybody is essentially at one level of the same. And, you know,
but what Owen said so clearly earlier in the program is that people aren't getting that either through democracy, either by electing politicians, or necessarily through the support of any military leaders.
Well, I mean, I don't think jobs are created by sort of, you know, politicians or military leaders. I mean, you know, your fundamental economic sort of, you know, economics of the country have to be in order. And, you know, that's where Pakistan really, I mean, that's where this government has, you know, done quite a lot. I mean, they've really cut down on spending. And it takes, I mean, it takes anywhere from 2 to 5 years before, like, the reforms will actually even kick in and people will see any real benefits from it.
Oh, and you're a little more skeptical in your book in terms of whether or not Musharraf's ever going to be able to get control of corruption, is ever going to be able to start, you know, taxing people and paying for an administration that way.
Yeah, two points. General Musharraf, you know, a lot of people say he's a good bloke, and you can see why, and he seems to be quite a reasonably motivated man. He's trying to do the right thing. However, the fact is he does not have the political will, sadly, to push through the kind of reforms that most Pakistanis would want. His anti-corruption campaign, much touted at the beginning, has gone absolutely nowhere, and he now basically is not bothering with it at all. When you come to issues like tax, yeah, I can't remember the precise figure. Hardly anyone in Pakistan pays any tax at all.
1 million.
And yeah, 1 million people out of 110 million pay tax. I mean, it's a joke, and he's not been able to deal with it. These problems, I mean, I'm not saying it's easy to deal with, but the fact is he's got a gun, and he, you know, might as well get on with it. He hasn't done it. And underlying all of that is that the big issue for Pakistan, in my view, which is that there is too little respect for the rule of law in the country. People do not obey the rules. People get away from the prime minister downwards. They get away with breaking the law. And unfortunately, it doesn't seem as if the last 3 years have seen much turnaround in that situation.
Connection listeners, we're talking about the recent elections in Pakistan, an expression at some level of some of the democracy that President Bush has been talking about in numerous speeches since September 11th, since before September 11th, about the need to try and spread some of the American values abroad in order to show people the quality of life that Americans take so much for granted. And yet what we're hearing is that the message isn't exactly being heard that way once it gets to Islamabad. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. With me on the program, Shakir Hussain, an independent reporter and columnist based in Karachi. Owen Bennett-Jones, former BBC correspondent for Pakistan and author of Pakistan, Eye of the Storm. We're taking a look at the elections, the evolving or perhaps not so evolving relationship between the United States and Pakistan. Our telephone number, once again, 1-800-423-TALK to join us. Let's go to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Farhaj is joining us. Hi, Farhaj.
How you doing? Quick question for you guys. My question was, I'm a Pakistani myself. I've been living abroad for the last, I guess, all my life, but from time to time I've been to Pakistan, and I do see that there's so many uneducated people there. The lack of education is incredible. And with this in mind, is it really possible that democracy right now could ever work in Pakistan? I just have a feeling that we're better off with someone like Musharraf in power, where he can crack down on all the corruption. I know and I've heard that he hasn't been doing a great job, but in my mind, in the last 3 years, he's done more than Benazir or Nawaz Sharif has done. So what kind of comment would you have on that, keeping in mind with the lack of education, are we fit enough as a country to have democracy?
Shakir, has Farhaj got it right there?
Well, yeah, I mean, the lack of education definitely is a factor in all of that. But also, I mean, I think this, all this, you know, this talk about exporting U.S. values and, you know, having U.S.-style democracy everywhere, it just doesn't work. I mean, you know, Iran, for instance, has democratic institutions. They've got a Majlis-e-Shura, which is, you know, basically a council, elected council. Now, in the U.S., that's not regarded as, you know, a U.S.-style democracy, but it is democratic. So, I mean, you know, different models fit for different countries. And, you know, you can't just say, well, you know, we've got U.S.-style values and we're going to export them and that's the kind, that's what we call democracy. And that just doesn't work. I mean, you know, people can point to the U.S. elections with Al Gore and Bush. You look at the state of Florida. And even the Pakistani press, the Urdu press, has sort of pointed to that on a number of occasions and said, hey, you guys are sort of the grandfathers of democracy here, and look what happened in your elections. Bush got 47% of the vote, and he's in office.
And Musharraf got X, and he's in office.
He didn't get any, but like, I mean...
No, I hear you. I'm not pushing back on there. Farhaj, thanks for your call. We want to go to Hartford now, and Vijay's on the line. Vijay.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a very simple question. Nobody's addressed the long-term trends of Islamization in Pakistan. You know, people have talked about the Afghanistan war as precipitating the reason for the MMA's success. The other thing in the equation is the IMF, its defunding of the social sector in Pakistan. This has created a lot of grief among working class and lower middle class, particularly the crackdown on public education, which led a lot of people into the madrasas. So it's not just the United States government, it's not just corruption in Pakistan, but I would like the two guests to talk a little bit about the role of the International Monetary Fund and the growth of faith-based education in Pakistan.
Owen, to you.
Right, the IMF aren't funding the social programs in Pakistan sufficiently. I think that is incontrovertible. That's plainly the case. And we heard earlier from someone saying that the US is blamed for everything, and you know, making this point that democracy. America's not promoting democracy, and why should we ever believe it? And of course, it's self-interested. If America is looking at the long term, it might want to consider the fact that if it doesn't provide funding, and of course, when we talk about the IMF, I'm afraid we have to talk once again about the US, because you are the predominant funder of it, and you have all the, you know, the vast bulk of the power on it. And if you don't fund these social programs, it is very likely that there will be a strongly anti-American Islamic government within, 10, 20, 25 years. That is likely, because people are desperate and they are sick of the military, they're sick of the Democrats, and they'll want something else. And if you are not offering something else with the resources you have available to do this, there will be a backlash which will be against America's interests. And it may be worth looking, you know, in that long term and trying to work out where this is going.
Okay, well, then help us with the something else. If the anything that shows up in Karachi with the stars and stripes on it is going to be rejected as tainted, is there a way for the United States to stay engaged, to work on issues like education without being seen to, you know, export values that people there don't want?
Of course there is. There are lots of ways of doing it. I mean, many people would say that straight direct aid programs don't work, and I can understand why they say that. They often get bogged down in corruption, and they often have sort of ideological and political little attachments on them, which people resent. But, you know, there is a major issue that the world faces, for example, in terms of free trade. You have your farmers being subsidized, and Europe does exactly the same, subsidizing its farmers. And at the same time, if a Pakistani farmer tries to sell something to Europe or the United States, which he could do far more cheaply, he will not be able to sell his goods on those markets. And indeed, it's worse than that. When the Europeans subsidize their farmers and manage to get these, you know, massive overproduction, what do? They go and sell it to countries like Pakistan at a cheap rate, undercutting the local farmers. Now, that is not a good way to go. And if you do that, these farmers will be desperately poor and looking for new solutions. And the solutions, I think, in Pakistan, they will find in radical Islam. And I don't know if that is what the West wants and whether it's really worth subsidizing farmers when you consider those long-term risks.
And yet it's that kind of long-term commitment, Vijay, that we keep hearing on the program. America is not willing or doesn't have the foresight to try and embrace.
We've just increased our military budget by $40 billion, but we're unable to take the long-term in terms of economic policy.
Gotcha. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
1-800-423-8255. Salem, Massachusetts now, and Sandra's there. Hi, Sandra.
Hi. I've been listening with great interest. I've been a Pakistan watcher since I lived there as a Peace Corps volunteer, 1961 to 63, a long time ago. And I just want to support many of the statements that I've heard today, and that is that from my view, the U.S.'s involvement in not only Pakistan but many of these countries is entirely self-serving, that we have, from the time that I was there many years ago, our relationship can only be described, in my estimation, as one of great complexity as well as duplicity. We try to promote ourselves as the generous benefactor, when in fact, if we are indeed trying to export our values, it's not to better the countries that we are in, it's to meet our own needs.
And nobody's buying it. Nobody's fooled. So what needs to be changed?
Well, but people are fooled. I think that if our government is still talking about working towards democracy in these countries, then they are assuming that citizens of the U.S. really believe that this can happen in the way that we are suggesting.
So it's a message for Americans. It's not a message for anybody outside the borders of this country,
right? Well, but we need to, I think so. I think people in all the other countries are fully aware of what's going on, but Americans, I fear, are not. What can change? I think that we could take many, many lessons from people abroad, particularly in those countries where we are trying to work. Peace Corps-type programs are great, except we weren't meant to accomplish a lot. We learned more than we could ever accomplish. But I think there was some accomplishment. But I think that there are lots of grassroots programs in those countries. In the Bangladeshi program, and I can't think of his name right now, the Grameen Bank, is that it?
Right, the microcredit.
Yeah.
Let me just take your advice here, if I can.
The World Bank paid no attention to that program until there was, I think, public outcry internationally that this is a program that needs to be supported. But yet we're looking to programs that can spend billions of dollars. For what?
Okay, let me just try and take your advice here and ask Shakir Hussain if I can give you half of the op-ed page in the New York Times to write the sort of column that Sandra says needs to be written and addressed to Americans in terms of what can work. Shakir, what would the lead be? What would you be saying?
Well, Sandra is right. You look at the Grameen Bank, which is now being ironically replicated by the World Bank in other countries. So what I would be saying is, instead of wasting all this money on very silly things, focus on social services, focus on education, because, the average person on the street, that's what they're looking for. And if you can provide, help the government provide these services, people will not turn to extremism or these fundamentalist parties. Because like Owen said, in 10 years' time, if this trend keeps going on the way it has, you will have people going out and voting en masse for these parties.
But the image of Pakistan, Shakir, is that if that money were to be given to the government, to be given to the people on the street, that half of it would end up in the bank accounts of those who are managing the money. That's
no,
the reputation.
There's ways to get around it. I mean, if the U.S. government can, supply Saddam Hussein's government in the 80s with chemical weapons, I'm sure they can deliver some aid in a side manner for Pakistan without being directly involved.
Owen Bennett-Jones, one of the things that you were talking about just a couple of minutes ago was rule of law, that people don't respect it, and they learn not to respect it by watching their leaders not respect it, by watching the theft and the corruption go on from among the people who are supposed to be setting the rules. Musharraf has spoken of his affection for Turkey's great leader Kemal Atatürk, and I think in a way fashions himself or fancies himself as someone who could follow in that mold. Has he got it?
No, unfortunately not. I mean, I say that with great regret, because I mean, I think it was a great chance for Pakistan, and in a sense, it's probably what they needed. And you could tell that he hadn't got it the day he made that statement. I was in Islamabad the day he said that, and the next day he retracted it, because the Islamic parties went crazy with him and said, you can't say this, and he's a secular guy, and this is terrible, and so on. And rather than facing them down, he just said, no, I never said it. And if I did say it, I didn't mean it. And, you know, you knew immediately that you were dealing with a military leader, yes, but a military leader who didn't actually have the political will just to force his way through. And it's partly a cultural issue. Everything in Pakistan works on consensus, and he wants to do it that way. And we all understand that all politicians, when they have a vision, and I think he does have a vision, have to make compromises and have to try and edge people towards their position. But my feeling is that he doesn't actually, you know, just in the terms you put it, he doesn't have what it takes, but therefore, sadly, it's not going to work out.
In the months since that time, though, he has stared down some of the Islamic parties, some of the more extreme groups who were operating in Kashmir, some of the, you know, trying to close.
No, he hasn't. No, I'm afraid not. I mean, he, you know, when the U.S. really put the screws on, he said, OK, I'm facing these people down. But, you know, my information is that the militants are once again crossing the line of control in Kashmir. I mean, I can understand that. It's a big national issue, and it's one that's very close to his heart. But the fact is, he said one thing. He seems to be doing something else, you know, maybe for the right reasons from his point of view. But, you know, when he says he's facing these people down, I'm not convinced.
So what is his vision?
His vision is for a moderate secular Pakistan, but I think he knows where he wants to go, but I don't believe he has the strength and will to get there. And, you know, it's a very sad situation because he was just perfectly placed to do it. And I can't see any democratic leader being able to do it, to face down the various radical forces that exist in Pakistan. It almost has to be done by, I mean, either a military strongman or a democratic leader of such charisma that they can, you know, appeal straight to the people and go over the heads of all these other various elements in Pakistani society. It was a chance, and I just don't think he's the man. Who knows? Maybe there'll be another military leader that comes after him. You know, that's one way of looking at it, but to be try and be optimistic about this.
Shakir, you haven't given up on Musharraf yet.
No, I haven't. I mean, like Owen said, the guy has, I mean, he's the only person I see today on today's political spectrum with a vision that most Pakistanis would agree with for a secular Pakistan, you know, that can move ahead in the century. But I haven't given up on him, no.
But what Owen's saying is that even if he has the vision, he doesn't have the wherewithal to make it work.
Yes, maybe Owen is right, but this is what we've got, and we've got to work with it.
Shakir, thanks for being with us.
No problem. Thank you.
Shakir Hussain is an independent reporter and columnist based in Karachi. Owen Bennett-Jones, thanks for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Nice to talk to you again. Owen is a BBC correspondent and presenter, author of Pakistan, Eye of the Storm. Connection listeners, we invite you to our forum page at our website. We're at theconnection.org. We had help with our program today from Kim Bichari, Dara Manoogi, and Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. Programs produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Arit Karitsky-Fox, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our interns are Carter Holleran and Meredith Levinson. Graham Smith is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
This is WBUR. Just ahead in the second hour of The Connection with Dick Gordon, author Umberto Eco. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Relax the Back, offering Tempur-Pedic mattresses, ultimate office chairs, zero gravity and massaging recliners, and hundreds of products for back pain relief and comfort. Relax the Back, 800-596-BACK.